The Conference of the United Nations on International Organization is now convened. We shall open the conference with 1 minute of silent and solemn meditation.
United States Secretary of State Edward Stettinius opening the San Francisco conference at which the Charter of the United Nations was drawn, April 25, 1945. I'm Richard Barr, and a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to speak with Alger Hiss, who was the Secretary General of that founding conference, about the origins of the United Nations. This conversation took place in Mr. Hiss's home. The United Nations Charter was ratified on October 24th of 1945, and it had been drafted and signed during a 2-month meeting in San Francisco from April to June of that year. And so on this day after the 40th anniversary of the ratification of the UN Charter, it is for me a great privilege to be able to be discussing these events, the forming of the United Nations, with the man who was Secretary General of that San Francisco meeting, Mr. Alger Hiss. Thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to hear your recollections on those events.
And I'm very glad to be talking to you, Mr. Barr.
Perhaps, although we're going to spend the majority of this discussion looking backward, we might take note of the events of the last week or so during which the UN's 40th anniversary is being celebrated. Do you have some reactions to the kinds of things that are being done and said during this week and their appropriateness?
Well, it seems to me entirely appropriate for the leaders of the world, the leaders of the member nations, all to come to the assembly session, join in the celebration. After all, when the UN was first being drafted in San Francisco, there was an outpouring of major world leaders too, so this is an appropriate counterpart, as it were, on its birthday celebration. I'm not sure I know just which statements you made. There have been a contrariety of statements, some critical of the UN and some full of praise. I happen to be one of those who think that the UN was an invaluable organization, and if it hadn't been founded when it was, it might never have been brought together. And one of its most important functions, it seems to me, is that it bridges the chasm which the Cold War has brought about between the United States and Soviet Union. It's one place where the two meet and can talk.
Do you find from the remarks of world leaders that you hear this week that there's sufficient awareness on most of their parts of the history and the intended purposes of the United Nations?
Many of the talks, the speeches that are given at assembly sessions, are really for domestic consumption at home. So I'm not surprised that there's not a great deal of analysis of the history of the UN. But I think it is important at this time, when the world is anxious about the danger of nuclear confrontation and even of nuclear war, to reaffirm the search for peace, which was the reason for causing the United Nations. I'd like to say right here that the whole impetus for the United Nations was the revulsion of the entire world at the carnage and destruction of World War II. And certainly now we're all aware that a new war, an atomic war, would be even more devastating. So the whole initial purpose of the UN is, in a sense, magnified, fortified in trying to use it as a symbol of the need for peace and as a forum where peaceful discussions can go forward.
Well, perhaps if we're going to attempt to discuss the origins and the founding of the UN today,
it might be useful to go even further back and look at its predecessor as an organization being formed in the aftermath of a world war with the intention of serving some of those very purposes that you just described to the UN. And that, of course, would be the League of Nations, formed at the close of World War I. Would you tell us a little bit about the origins of the League?
Well, as you have put it yourself in a capsule form, the League was formed at the end of World War I, hoping thereby to provide a forum where nations could discuss their differences. One of the weaknesses of the League was that it was never universal. It not only did not have the United States, we refused to join, but many areas of the world were not represented at all, Africa and a good deal of the Far East. Also, it had very limited authority and power. When the Charter of the United Nations was under preparation, the lessons of the League were borne very much in mind. And one of the principal tenets of the United Nations was that it would have universality, that every nation in the world would someday be permitted to join. That definitely included those nations which had been enemy nations and which naturally were not invited to the founding conference. And that purpose has been pretty well achieved. There were 50 nations that signed the charter, and now there are over 150 large and small nations. So universality has been achieved.
Well, in that we will later on in this discussion focus on some of President Roosevelt's strategies for paving the way for the United Nations, maybe as a contrast, we might take a look at what mistakes President Wilson made that resulted in the United States never joining the League, even though it had been a goal that he held very dearly.
I think that one of Wilson's chief mistakes was failing to include ranking members of the Senate in his planning and in his deliberations. Roosevelt had been a sub-cabinet member of Wilson's wartime cabinet. He was Assistant Secretary of Navy and a great enthusiastic supporter of the League. He was disappointed at our failure to join it. If there's any one person who is responsible for the UN plan, program for it coming into being, I think it's Franklin Roosevelt. Early on, he saw to it that studies were being prepared in Washington, going back over the League's troubles and planning what would be necessary for a future United Nations. And from the outset, he was careful to include members of Congress, in that case both senators and representatives, in his planning. And he was meticulous in seeing to it that public support was maintained so far as possible. So this, I think, was where Roosevelt benefited by and avoided the mistakes that President Wilson had made.
In fact, the League had been headquartered in Geneva, had it not? Starting, I think, in 1919.
Certainly had.
Now, it was still in existence during the 1930s when the conflicts began to flare up that were eventually to lead to World War II. Did the League ever have any success in performing its intended function as world conflicts began to boil up in the 30s?
Very little success. And again, one of its weaknesses was that the United States was not a participant. In fact, the refusal of the Senate to approve the League of Nations made the State Department so timid that it didn't even have a formal observer reporting on League of Nations matters. And when the United Nations study groups were started in the State Department, they did not refer to a future organization. When I became head of the division that handled UN preparations and then UN relations, it was called the Department of Special Political Affairs. So this shows the great distance the United States officially kept from the League. So it's no wonder that the League had very little influence in trying to prevent Hitler and Mussolini from pushing ahead with violation after violation, such as the war against Ethiopia and the war in Spain.
Isn't it generally true that the great powers preferred pretty much going their own way and weren't too willing to be subject to League directives?
And that is one of the problems today. The United Nations itself cannot do anything that its member nations do not authorize it to do.
Since we're now somewhere in the 1930s in this saga, just to insert a little biographical information, if I'm correct, you had graduated from Harvard Law School in the late 1920s and then worked for Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes for 2 years.
That's correct. Then practiced law in Boston and again in New York before I joined the New Deal.
And you have been described many times as an avid New Dealer and a great admirer of Franklin Roosevelt. Is one reference that I'd read about your listening to his inaugural address in March of 1933 and getting this tremendous sense of great things about to happen and being drawn towards working on them in Washington. Is that
That's
accurate?
Very true, yeah. Now, I'd been a supporter of Roosevelt all during his campaign, and I had known a great deal about him from Professor Frankfurter, who was one of his advisors. Frankfurter was a professor of mine at the law school, who later became the Supreme Court Justice. So that I joined the New Deal with a great feeling that I was having the opportunity to participate in a crusade against the Depression and a chance to bring about needed reforms.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
There were many young lawyers who joined the administration in that first 100 days, were there not?
There certainly were.
And would you say that the sense that has been conveyed to us of a real charged idealism pervading Washington is an accurate one?
It was a very inspiring, heady period, particularly for young people. We had responsibilities we'd not had a chance to assume before, and what we considered an inspiring leader and champion in FDR.
And your first position was in what was a newly formed branch of the Agriculture Department.
Yes, it was called the Agricultural Adjustment Administration.
And that was a part of the Agriculture Department that was created in the Roosevelt administration?
The AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, was set up by legislation passed during the first 100 days. That's correct.
And
its purpose was to help raise farm prices to, in large part by reducing the production of farm commodities a practice that still continues. In return for their reduction, the farmers, reduction of acreage, the farmers would be paid benefit payments. And therefore, there was a dual purpose: to increase their income by payments and to increase their income by raising the price of their products.
And you spent about 2 years with the AAA?
I was there until I joined the Department of Justice to help prepare the brief defending the constitutionality of the AAA. And from there, I went straight to the State Department.
And that was when, 1936?
In 36, I went to the State Department.
Now, I've read that the idea, though, of international diplomacy was one that you had been very interested in far earlier, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, even from high school days. And as a matter of fact, I went to law school on the advice of a professor of international law who thought that a law training was the best way to prepare for taking the Foreign Service exams. But once I got in law school, particularly after I had the chance to serve as Justice Holmes' secretary, I found the law so inviting that I put off the idea of foreign service and international affairs more or less indefinitely. So it was a happy chance for me when I was asked by the State Department to move from the Department of Justice to the Department of State in 1936. That sort of combined my legal interests and my interest in international relations.
Had you all the way through until that point in the back of your mind thought you'd get back to this sooner or later, or had you begun to think perhaps that you'd missed that opportunity for good?
I think I had not allowed myself to think too much about it. I was preoccupied with my daily activities, but I continued to follow foreign policy with great interest in foreign affairs, so that in Washington, even while at the Department of Agriculture, I participated in groups that had meetings on foreign affairs. So I never lost my interest in the field.
But the work schedule in the early days of the New Deal was, I understand, long hours, and it didn't leave time for thinking about too much else.
That's quite true. It was a very hectic schedule we followed.
Well, what were some of the kinds of things you worked on in your early years in the State Department from 1936?
I went primarily to work on trade agreements. They are international bilateral agreements between the United States and other countries for mutual tariff reductions. And I worked on the possible defense of that act in court and on the drafting of agreements. I worked as an assistant to Assistant Secretary Francis Sayre, who had been Woodrow Wilson's son-in-law, tying in again with the League of Nations and my interest in such things. After my chief, Mr. Sayre, went to the Philippines as High Commissioner, I was transferred to the Far Eastern field and worked there under Dr. Stanley Hornby on the problems leading up to Pearl Harbor. Our relations were primarily with China and Japan, and from Pearl Harbor on until about 1943, I worked on matters relating to aid to China, including Lend-Lease, and in 43 was moved to preparation for the development of the United Nations and stayed in that field until I left the State Department in 1947.
Now, did President Roosevelt begin to conceive of what was later to be the United Nations even before our official entry into the war in December of 41?
Yes, he was so impressed with the need of preparing for the peace while the war went on, that he persuaded Churchill to endorse an Atlantic Charter in August of 1941.
And what did that charter in effect proclaim?
Well, it called primarily for like-minded nations of a democratic outlook coming together. So one could say that it prefigured the United Nations. It was, in a sense, a bridge in thought, at least, between the League and the future United Nations. And then once we were in the war because of Pearl Harbor, the Allied Nations, the alliance, became known as the United Nations. And they became, of course, the nucleus for the world organization that we are talking about, whose birth is being celebrated now.
So now Roosevelt, since he was already by 1941 thinking about a post-war organization like this, had to contend with strains of isolationism in American politics and society on two fronts, both in terms of masterminding our entry into the war and thinking ahead to how to sell an organization like this, a world organization like this, to the American people for after the war, so that he wouldn't fail where in the way that Woodrow Wilson had.
Yeah, the way you phrased that question made it sound a little as though he had planned all along on entering the war. That is an implication that I'm not in a position to support. I think he always believed in aiding the Allies. We know that because he adopted various means of aiding the Allies, the destroyer deal and other, and his sympathies were strongly there. What he did need to do, certainly, was to convince the American public that it was in our interest and it was right and appropriate to aid the Allies because, as you have pointed out, there were strong isolationist attitudes in this country. And then, once we were in the war through the action of the Japanese at Pearl Harbor, he had to carefully prepare public opinion and the political authorities in Congress for acceptance of the United Nations. And this was a very thoroughly thought through and carefully followed plan. You're absolutely right. You put your finger on it. And that's why I said earlier that there's one person who seems largely responsible for the whole concept of the United Nations as an organization. It is Franklin Roosevelt. Now, I should add here that the British and the Russians were so preoccupied with sheer survival that they had relatively little manpower to devote to preparation of studies for the United Nations, so that we, with our large numbers and our large population and our not having such heavy immediate involvement, were able to detail a sizable staff to work on United Nations studies. And it is fair to say, without taking too much credit on ourselves, that the United States, for that reason, was really the architect of the United Nations. The preliminary meeting, Del Martin Oaks, was held here. We were the host at San Francisco, and most of the detailed proposals had been worked out within the State Department. And in negotiation with the British and Russians, we made compromises, we made changes, but the United States was the architect of the United Nations.
In the beginning of 42, 26 countries signed a declaration of the United Nations.
Yes, this, of course, was an actual alliance proposal.
And what was pledged in that declaration?
Much the same goal that came later, that and very similar to Wilsonian ideals, that the, in the peace that would follow, there would be respect for national sovereignty and territories, and that there would be an emphasis on independence and an emphasis on free association within an international organization after the war.
But also within that declaration, which was a declaration among allies at the time, wasn't there something about not making a separate peace?
Oh yes, you're referring now more to the alliance aspect. I was thinking of looking forward to the future UN of which this was the genesis. Oh yes, this was a wartime document. Just as each of the three conferences I've referred to were carried on during wartime and had to take account of wartime needs and demands.
Well, now that Declaration of the United Nations was signed in early 42, and in late October of 43, we come to the Moscow Declaration. But in between, could you describe in that almost two-year period what was going on?
Well, within the State Department, under Secretary Hull, who was then the Secretary, and who himself was a strong Wilsonian Democrat, the studies of what would be needed to have a true United Nations went forward. They were elaborate studies. The people comprising that group were law professors, lawyers, international specialists. For example, there had to be a schedule for turning the League of Nations mandates either into independent countries or into wards of the United Nations, which became called trusteeships. There had to be plans about the peace, what would be done with various Axis territories that would be removed from them. They were to be made trusteeships too. There was a plan to have an economic and social council, as it eventually, as it eventuated in course of time. The League had not done much with economic matters. The feeling was that a true international organization had also to interest itself in economic affairs. There was a study of the things that later became known as the specialized agencies, like the World Health Organization, UNESCO, and all the technical fields that require international multilateral negotiations. The secret success, the secret of the success of the United Nations with most countries is the bilateral diplomacy is no longer feasible when there are 150 separate nations. It would just take too long to go around the circle of negotiating one by one. So the United Nations gives an umbrella under which groups can meet to formulate plans in regard to postal service, which had grown up under the League, control of aviation, international regulations of communications, radio and television, all the food and agriculture, children's fund, all the things that require some appropriate interrelationship among nations, and which can only be furthered effectively these days by multilateral negotiations.
So there was, from what you say, a good deal of pre-planning and homework being done, largely in the State Department?
Exactly.
To prepare for this post-war arrangement?
Yes, we conferred. This went on, of course, after 43, too, after the Moscow Declaration. What I've described was not just the first studies. They continued right up, indeed, until the San Francisco Conference in 45. We conferred with the British as we went forward, and to some extent, to a lesser degree, with the Russians.
But it was largely a U.S. effort.
Largely the State Department that did the detailed work.
Now, while this was going on, as far as the League of Nations was concerned, the last act that I've seen attributed to the League of Nations prior to officially giving up the ghost, I think in 1946, was to expel the USSR in 1940. Was there anything practically going on within the League of Nations between 40 and 46?
If so, I have to admit I was not aware of it. I think one can call it moribund.
So anybody serious about international organization realized that it had to come from the formation of a new one at that time?
I made an overstatement, somewhat facetiously. From 40 to 46, it did make attempts to have some influence on the Axis powers as Italy and Germany became more and more lawbreakers of international law. We discussed this a little earlier. The League was quite ineffective for a variety of reasons, largely because the U.S. was not a member, and certainly its effectiveness was lessened after the expulsion of the Soviet Union.
Well, the Moscow Declaration comes out at the end of October 43 and essentially states the need for a replacement for the League of Nations. Is the Dunbarton-Oaks Conference several months later in the fall of 1944 that you've alluded to the next
main step? Yes, that was the next important development in the growth of the whole concept.
In the meanwhile, it should be pointed out you had become, I think in April of 44, the Deputy Director of the Office of Special Political Affairs?
Yes.
So there, in that capacity, you then played a large role in
Dunbarton-Oaks. I acted as the secretary of the Dunbarton-Oaks talks.
And the U.S. delegate was Under Secretary Stettinius?
There were a number of delegates, but Stettinius was the head of the delegation. That's true.
Well, can you give us some detail on the Dunbarton-Oaks Conference?
Yes. We met, first let's say where it was. It was in a beautiful estate in Georgetown section of Washington.
I'd heard that there had initially been some talk about having it out in Montauk.
There was, and I was one of the people who pointed out that would have been technically very difficult for communications, for the British and the Russians, and later the Chinese, to communicate with their capitals, and it was a very isolated spot. So when we were able to obtain the Dunbarton-Oaks estate, which was a self-contained unit with a wall around it, that served the purpose of privacy and still was within easy touch of the various embassies.
So the participating delegates could remain housed at their own embassies.
That's right.
And come to the conference?
Exactly.
So that did that conference last for a long time?
It lasted for about 5 weeks, August, September, and I think into the first few days of October. It began with just the British, the United States, and the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was then neutral in the war with Japan, and felt that China should not participate. After the discussions with the Russians, and after they therefore had withdrawn, the Chinese delegation with the British and the Americans went over much the same ground. But it did ensure, in form at least, that the Chinese were brought in at that early stage to consultation on the future of the United Nations. It meant the Far East was not being eliminated, as it had been in the case of the League of Nations.
Functioning as Secretary General for this conference, were there some particularly difficult tasks that you had to negotiate your way through?
Well, I kept all the minutes, but it was a surprisingly harmonious meeting. One would have thought, now that one looks back and realizes the strains and the divergences of policy, that there would have been more tensions. The only big disagreement came over the issue of over two issues, really. The biggest issue was over how many votes the Soviet Union should have. At one time, the proposal was made that the Soviet Union wanted all of its constituent states to be members of the United Nations. Roosevelt, when this was reported to him, said this was obviously ridiculous because they were not independent states. This, we realized, was bargaining talk, and at Yalta, that was settled in terms of the Soviet Union and two of its member states being members of the United Nations, a big change from the first request for 16. But we found difficulty in agreeing on the veto. The American position was that each of the major powers should be able to veto important policy decisions by the Security Council, that the General Assembly should have independent voting. Every nation should have one vote. But the Security Council, the so-called permanent members, the great powers, should have the right of veto. This, at first, the British were not sure of, and the Russians wanted to study at least the form. So that was left suspended. Also, we were unable to reach agreement partly because of passage of time on the terms for an Economic and Social Council and also a Trusteeship Council. This necessitated the later meeting that year, the beginning of the next year, at Yalta. Though in December, we substantially reached agreement, it seemed to me, by telegram interchange, on the voting procedure in the Security Council, the so-called veto provision. So that when we got to Yalta, there was less hanging fire than might otherwise have been.
Well, so then that brings us to the famous, controversial, to some infamous, Yalta conference in early 45. I imagine this is a fascinating story for the conference was at the time and remained afterwards bathed in controversy depending upon one's outlook, and certainly it became a focal point for many of those who'd been bitter opponents of Roosevelt and his policies after the fact, criticize what had occurred there as a sellout to the Russians or whatever. But why don't you, as again, somebody who was on the scene and very much involved, tell us a little bit about that Yalta Conference?
Well, it certainly was the high watermark of Allied cooperation.
Where is Yalta,
we
first
met
of all?
At Yalta, in the Crimea, on the Black Sea, and it actually is a seaside water resort in temperature and climate and flora. It's very much like Charleston, South Carolina. We were comfortably housed. There is no question but what the stage of the war was such that it was essential that the three major powers, the British, the French, and the British, the Russians, and ourselves, reach agreement. The French were not invited because it was felt that the Free French government, Free French regime, was not sufficiently established to consider it an independent government. This became an annoyance to De Gaulle and took some time later to iron out. But at Yalta itself, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin had many points of disagreement, but your characterization of it as a source of controversy at the time, publicly, I think misses the mood of the world at the time. When the Yalta communique was issued, there was general acclaim that the Allied powers had insisted upon continued unity and upon a clear defeat of the Axis, and had announced their plans for a world organization. It was only later, when the streams of separate national aspirations became more apparent, that Yalta was asserted to be a source of controversy and mistakes. It could not be a sellout because we had nothing that we could give away. When people speak of sellout, they say we sold out Eastern Europe and Poland, but Poland and Eastern Europe were not ours to give. The Soviet troops had overrun Eastern Europe, driving the Germans out, and were then, at the time of Yalta, engaged in doing the same in Poland. The Battle of the Bulge had just occurred in the West, showing how strong the Germans still were. So the necessity for unity was very great, and certainly none of the supporters of the Western powers wanted the Russians to stop grinding up the German war machine in the East. So I think that what occurred at Yalta was agreement that the three powers believed would facilitate future unity. If there was one topic that all three of the leaders emphasized, it was the need for unity. The divergences that have occurred since, it seems to me, cannot be blamed on Yalta. There was nothing at Yalta that in any way impaired American national interests or British. And as you know, that the one of the arguments about Yalta is that Roosevelt, who died 10 weeks later, was not well, not competent. No one has said that about Churchill. And in fact, Roosevelt was thoroughly intellectually competent. He didn't look well when he arrived, but he handled himself with complete adequacy throughout. This is a complex subject about which whole books have been written. We're not going to be able to dispose of it in this brief compass that really is more on the United Nations.
Are there, though, some fascinating anecdotes about the interactions of three large world figures like Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin that you might care to relate to us?
Well, again, they were more general than just on the UN. Stalin was a very able negotiator, and he obviously made a point of teasing Churchill, who rose to the bait. For example, when Churchill would insist on the rights of small nations because he was worried about what Stalin would do in control of Eastern Europe, Stalin would reply, "Oh, you mean like Egypt, where the British had been in control for a long time?" And this obviously was meant to be a teasing of Churchill. Roosevelt obviously enjoyed the barbs and the teasing, because none of it was directed at him. There were any number of occasions when the three of them were actually in good humor, and the tensions were less than one would have expected.
Did Roosevelt tend to play the most conciliatory role of the three, or would you say that in general the mood was conciliatory?
I think in general the mood was conciliatory.
Who were some of the other members of the delegations you might mention?
Well, Eden was there as Churchill's chief aide, Molotov for Stalin, Harry Hopkins was there with Stettinius, who was Roosevelt's chief aide, Secretary of State Stettinius, so that you had the three foreign ministers, as they were called. And the way the conference functioned was for the foreign ministers to meet in the morning as a committee, as it were, to deal with problems. If they could resolve them, that settled it. If they couldn't, then they were passed on to the plenary session, where the three heads of government met every afternoon. And the foreign ministers were also used as a drafting committee. If the plenary session agreed in principle but wanted something worked out in detail, they would refer it to the foreign ministers.
I hope that you will pardon me for an unusual posture of sitting down during the presentation of what I want to say. But I know that you will realize that it makes it a lot easier for me in not having to carry about 10 pounds of steel around on the bottom of my legs, and also because of the fact that I have just completed a 14,000-mile trip. Speaking in all frankness, the question of whether it is entirely fruitful lies to a great extent in your hands.
All right, well, as you've said, Yalta being February of 45, and the next big event in the beginnings of the UN being the San Francisco conference, of which began in late April, in between comes Roosevelt's death. I'm sure it must have had some very profound impact on the orderly procession of events leading up to the founding of the UN, as well as, no doubt, a very strong personal impact, since you were a a loyal Roosevelt lieutenant all the way through. Would you care to make a stop here at that point and discuss it a little before going on?
Yes, at the time of Roosevelt's death at Warm Springs, he was actually working on a speech which it was planned he would give at the opening of the UN. So this was something he must have looked forward to for a long time. And as the progenitor of the whole United Nations, this would have been the culmination for him of years of effort and planning. So that this was a blow to all of us, and also meant that his successor was someone who had had no direct participation in the UN planning, Truman. And
is it true that Truman even was unfamiliar at that point with the details of what had been agreed to at Yalta?
I can't be sure, but he knew very little about what had gone on, and had a far from conciliatory attitude toward the Russians. When the Germans invaded Russia in June of 1941, the day of the actual invasion, Truman, who was then a senator, made a statement which the New York Times printed on the front page of its next day's edition, that he, Senator Truman, thought we should aid whichever side was losing. In other words, he was saying the Soviet Union was no better than the Nazis, and obviously this must be something that they were fully aware of, reported on the front page of the Times, and must have rankled for years. The San Francisco conference got off to a bad start, which would not have been the case if Roosevelt lived. Molotov, on his way to San Francisco, had an audience in the White House, and Truman berated him for what he called the violations already of the Yalta agreements relating to Poland. And Molotov, who was certainly no more conciliatory in personality than Truman, took offense and said he'd never been spoken to like this in his life. And Truman, like a schoolmaster, said, well, if you'll keep your agreement, you won't be spoken to like that. I saw Mr. Stettinius, who'd been present at that altercation the next morning, and he was pale with anxiety. He said he thought quite likely that at that moment that Molotov would take such offense that he would go back, not go to San Francisco, in which case the whole vitality of the UN would have been dissipated. There could have been no effective UN without Soviet participation.
Indeed, the accession to power of Harry Truman, just as the UN was about to begin with his substantially more belligerent attitude towards the Soviet Union than Roosevelt had had, cast a die almost from the start, didn't it, that the UN would in fact develop along somewhat different lines than perhaps Roosevelt had envisioned, less cooperative lines.
It seems to me that it can be said that is in fact what occurred. As the history books have it, it's merely the difference in policies between, in objectives, aspirations between Soviet Union and the United States. But I'm convinced that had Roosevelt lived, the degree of hostility that arose and has arisen between the United States and Soviet Union would have been greatly lessened.
Well, now, San Francisco, is there a story in how San Francisco came to be the site of this 2-month conference?